Just 1 week ago, the U.S. was on the brink of an armed conflict with Iran, and tensions are still high. Today, we'll talk about that with Senator Tammy Duckworth. Plus, what's the difference between feeling stressed and experiencing burnout? And how can understanding the difference help challenge stigma around mental health? And we're halfway through 2019. We're talking about the best movies so far this year while also looking forward to what's coming this summer.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about the movies you can't miss this summer with the AV Club's Katie Reif. Plus, researchers and medical experts are redefining what it means to have burnout, and it could change the way we think about work-life balance. But first, last week, President Trump approved a military strike on Iran after the country shot down a U.S. surveillance drone. The U.S. said the drone was in international waters. Iran said the drone was in their airspace. According to the New York Times, American planes and ships were already in position for an attack last Thursday, but then the president pulled back and avoided armed conflict with Iran for now. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have been increasing for a while. It's been more than a year since the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. There have been more sanctions, and for the last few weeks, Trump administration officials have blamed Iranian forces for a series of attacks, first on oil tankers and then on a U.S. drone. Earlier this week, Senator Tammy Duckworth delivered an impassioned speech on the Senate floor about the Trump administration's stance on Iran, and she said it's long past time for Congress to assert its legal authority when it comes to matters of war. I spoke with Senator Duckworth yesterday afternoon, and I started by asking how she felt when she first learned President Trump had called off the strike.
Well, I was absolutely flabbergasted that we were 10 minutes away from a war with Iran, which is where we were. We were 10 minutes away from the president launching a first strike against Iran at a time when they had not attacked us or U.S. forces. And I was blown away because the president does not have the constitutional authority to declare war and to do that. He has self-defense capability, but not a first strike when we, you know, and we there was no imminent a threat. The Iranians had attacked the two tankers, and yes, they had shot down a drone, but you know, they've not attacked U.S. forces. So I was very much surprised. I'm glad that he made the decision that he did, but it just made this whole issue of the need to debate an authorization for use of force much more urgent here in the United States Senate.
Right. And so that law, as you mentioned, it's called the Authorization for Use of Military Force, which lets the president order attacks on anyone who aided in the attacks on September 11th. This is, you know, September 11th attacks in 2001. But this has now been used to allow military action in many different countries. Do you think Congress should just repeal this altogether?
Yes. Congress must repeal the AUMF. We can do it several ways. We can outright repeal. We can have it sunset because we still do have some troops, of course, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. That new AUMF was voted on and passed in order to go after al-Qaeda. What is happening in Iran is not al-Qaeda. And so to stretch the AUMF to say that it would cover U.S. military actions in Iran, number one, is illegal. And number two is a real disservice to our troops who might have to go to Iran because they deserve to know that they have the legal authority to be there and that they have the full backing of the country behind them. And to have them go without the an AUMF to provide them the guidelines for their actions is really a disservice to the men and women who wear the uniform.
And obviously, you're very familiar with what it's like to serve in the military. And, you know, you talked about this on the Senate floor about whether or not you agree with the commander in chief when you sign up to be in the military, you agree to follow orders. I wonder how when we think about the U.S. and the military conflicts we've been in the past 10 or 15 years, how this escalation in Iran, do you think it's different in terms of its effect on our troops?
Well, I think that We've been at war now for well over a decade, 17 years. And in fact, this is just adding on. We've not had in our nation's history 17 years of war and then the declaration of a new war against a new enemy. And so this is new territory for us. And frankly, our military is stretched thin. I have friends right now, who have done eight deployments. Can you imagine? And none of that was imagined when we passed that first authorization when we first invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. And so it is troubling what we're doing with Iran. And it is troubling that the White House wants to push us towards a war in Iran at a time when we still haven't even resolved what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. And certainly when there are other options to deal with Iran without setting up the conditions for us to go to war.
So you said that the Trump administration seems to, quote, be making foreign policy decisions not based on this country's interests, but to serve some ideology or political purpose. What ideology do you mean?
Well, I think that this stems from John Bolton, the president's advisor, who's I think is the guy who's calling the shots here. I really think he's calling the shots more so than the president. And thank goodness the president realized what was happening and caught off the strike over the weekend. But this is John Bolton. He's always espoused, ever since he was ambassador to the United Nations, a very hardline ideological stance about the Middle East. He is quite the warmonger, and he has been someone who has been giving speeches, making comments about how we should go to war with Iran. So that's the ideology that is, occupying the advisory role in the White House right now. And I don't think that that's helpful. And I was elected to represent the people of the state of Illinois. It's my job, my responsibility to have these discussions, to have this debate on the floor of the Senate. I'm not being given the ability to do that and to do my job on behalf of the people of Illinois.
And so when the National Security Advisor John Bolton said, so obviously this goes back when we're thinking about U.S. and Iranian relations, there's a very long history here. But when we're just thinking about this short timeline in this most recent event, on May 5th, the U.S. deployed an aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf. And John Bolton said at that time, the U.S. wasn't seeking a war with the Iranian regime, but that was just being fully prepared to respond to any attack. Do you think that the stance that we have taken in Iran right now is creating more problems, it sounds like?
Very much so. I think the very conditions that Mr. Bolton has said would be the reasons why we go to war with Iraq. There's two in particular. One is if they attack the United States, or two, if they develop their nuclear weapons program beyond where it is right now. And so what did Mr. Bolton and President Trump do? They pulled the United States out of the nuclear treaty, which then freed up Iran to go ahead and develop the nuclear program because, hey, we're no longer adhering to the treaty. So the Iranian says, well, now we don't have to adhere to it either. So now they're ramping up their nuclear program. And then by sending the carrier into the Gulf, we're setting up the conditions for the second reason, which is if they attack Americans. And well, so let's send an entire aircraft carrier out there to be potential targets. It's very much circular logic here. We should be working with our allies to further restrain Iran. We should not actually be goading them and pushing them into attacking us.
Mm-hmm. And so, working with our allies, what other kind of approach should we be taking with Iran? Because obviously, I know that, and you said this on the Senate floor, this is a country that we have to be very careful about our relations with.
Oh, we definitely must be careful about Iran. Let me make it clear. Iran is not our friend, and Iran has supported terrorists. They have until recently made payments to Hamas to sustain Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, and a terrorist organization that, for example, has denied the right of Israel to exist as a nation. And so let's be clear. Iran is not our friend. That said, we had put constraints on them with the Iran nuclear deal, where we kept them in a program where they could not, and they were adhering to the program by not increasing their nuclear program. We need to work with our allies on the sanctions. The sanctions regime was working, and we were getting the Iranians to where we needed them to be. And in fact, the sanction regimes were so effective that they have now stopped payments to Hamas. And so, we need to allow these things to work. We need to pull our allies together not get into a kinetic war with Iran, which might actually splinter off some of our allies who do not want to be at war.
And when you say it was working, what do you mean by that?
Well, by keeping our allies together and keeping people from buying oil from Iran, we were denying Iran access to capital so that they did not have cash to give to terrorist organizations like Hamas, for example.
My guest is Senator Tammy Duckworth. We are speaking to her about a conversation share, a speech she made on the Senate floor this week about Iran. And I wanted to just go back to one other point, because we started this conversation talking about President Trump and his actions. We were talking about the authorization for use of military force, your belief that that should be repealed. You and other Democrats have said many times that it's Congress that has the power to declare war, not the president. If the president were to launch an attack, if it was Iran, what recourse does Congress have? What would you do in response?
Well, we have the power of the purse. We can cut off funding to the Department of Defense. And that's what the framers of the Constitution did. And those are the powers that they gave to Congress. And let me just clarify. I think that we should be sunsetting or repealing the authorization for use of military force against Qaeda as a result of the 9/11 attacks. I also do believe that we need to debate a new AUMF that has to do specifically with Iran. And if during that debate and we're given evidence that shows that we should actually be using military force against Iran, then we'll have that vote. And we may vote yes on it. But to use an authorization from 17 years ago that was meant to go after al-Qaeda and those who attacked us on 9/11 in order to go to war against Iran is wrong. And we need to do our jobs here in the Senate and really have two debates. One, which is to sunset the old AUMF, and two, to have a new debate on a new AUMF.
Speaking of debates, on Wednesday and Thursday night, there will be two Democratic primary debates. 20 candidates in total will be taking the stage in Miami. What do you want to hear from different people running for office, for the office of president, for the office of commander in chief, about our stance that we should be taking, not just on Iran, but as we're thinking about tensions within the Middle East?
Well, what I want to hear from them is an acknowledgement and a support for sunsetting of the old AUMF and the need to debate a new AUMF. I also want to hear their acknowledgement that the power to declare war sits with the Congress of the United States, sits with the Senate. It does not rest in the White House per the Constitution of the United States. In addition to issues of whether or not we should go to war, I think I want to see and hear them talk about support for our military families, making sure that they get the pay raises that they need, making sure that our caregivers are given the support that they need to take care of wounded family members, that we are there for military families, and that we are going to support our military men and women, both while they're still serving and when they become veterans. And lastly, in addition to issues of national security, I want them to talk about other issues of national strength, which is just American manufacturing and our agricultural sector. The industrial Midwest should be a part of the topic of a conversation during these debates.
I guess it's too early to ask if there's anyone you're specifically rooting for, right, Senator Duckworth?
No, I don't have anyone in particular I'm rooting for. But what I do want is I do want a Midwestern and a mountain states person to stay in the debates and in the race as long as possible, because I think they will force the discussions to include issues that have to do with the industrial Midwest, with manufacturing, with agriculture. I don't want the debates and the discussion on the campaign trail to just be a whole series of progressive litmus tests, whether it's Medicare for all, whether it is, any of the other issues, whether it's debt-free or free college education. I think all of those things are important, but I also think we need to talk about the need to invest in American manufacturing, the need to support our farmers. In Illinois, we had a devastating spring this spring. Our farmers, some of them didn't even get to plant until the beginning of January. So we need to talk about support for our ag sector, support for our for industry as well. And so I think the Mountain State and Midwestern candidates will allow us to keep the focus on those issues for as long as possible.
Senator Tammy Duckworth, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be on. Thank you.
On Tuesday afternoon, a sheriff deputy in Fulton County was shot and killed while responding to a domestic disturbance in the village of Avon. That's about an hour west of Peoria. Deputy Troy Chisholm was 39 years old and had served in the sheriff's office for 4.5 years. He was also a paramedic and part of the West Central Special Response Team, and he was a husband and a father. A suspect named Nathan Woodring was taken into custody yesterday morning after a standoff that lasted 18 hours. ISP says they're still investigating the shooting. There will be services this coming Sunday and Monday to honor Deputy Chisholm. On Sunday, there'll be visitations in the afternoon to early evening at Cuba High School. The funeral service will also be at Cuba High School on Monday. Yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill that doubles the amount of financial help families of fallen law enforcement officers and firefighters can receive for things like burial costs. Now, the state can reimburse families for up to $20,000, and it applies to this starting from June 30th of last year onwards. In a statement, Governor Pritzker said, quote, "My heart breaks for the families, friends, and fellow first responders every time a brave soul leaves us in the noblest of ways. A grateful state will always honor your legacies." Coming up after the break, the World Health Organization is learning more about what it actually means to experience burnout. We'll talk about that and how it fits into maintaining work-life balance. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Many of us have experienced a feeling of being burnt out. A long week at work or at home can leave us feeling exhausted, both physically and emotionally. But when does everyday stress turn into something more serious? Now, the World Health Organization has changed and clarified its definition of burnout and separated it from other stress syndromes. Researchers hope this change will bring more awareness and more options for treatment. Samantha Coleman is a professor in industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. She's on the line with us now for more on this. Professor Coleman, thank you for being here. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Professor Coleman, when we say burnout, what do we mean by that? Because I think there are a lot of popular definitions of this, and this is something that people say all the time, oh, I'm burnt out. But what should we be thinking about this from a clinical standpoint?
From a clinical standpoint, I think that we should really be looking at burnout as, you know, really a work-related struggle that we are experiencing, mostly between ourselves and our work. So almost like this relationship that we have. And when it becomes too overwhelming and too much for us to be able to handle, we come to a place where we are both physically and emotionally exhausted. And because of that, we begin to experience any number of symptoms, such as fatigue or insomnia, or even coming down to our workplace performance. So all of these things kind of, you know, come together in a nice little medley, if you will, that results in us feeling depleted.
And so when we say depleted, how can we distinguish this from, say, a usual stressful time? I mean, people go through stressful periods at work. Some people have stressful jobs. How can we distinguish this from everyday work stress?
So burnout, I would say, is something that you continue to feel day in and day out, and it's hard for you to shake. It's something where when that depletion begins to set in, it isn't just, oh, I had a bad day, I'm able to come home, relax, and begin anew. Burnout tends to stay with us, you know, for a little bit, to the point, for instance, where it might even be a couple of weeks where we just have a very hard time getting back in the game, right? Like whatever it is that we may have scheduled, we may not be making those appointments, or we might be missing, you know, assignments that we need to get in. It comes to a point where it begins to impact us both in our work, but then also interpersonally, you know, as well, perhaps with colleagues, supervisors, et cetera.
And so are there commonalities that people experience when they're feeling burnt out? You mentioned a couple physical symptoms, oftentimes maybe people having things like insomnia, for example, or fatigue. But is there, and I imagine this could probably manifest in a lot of different physical ways, right?
So the thing about it is, when you're speaking like from a clinical, you know, perspective, and you're tying those symptoms in, a lot of it is really determined by the amount of time something goes on. So for instance, you can feel fatigued, right, for one day, and you're able to shake it off and move on. But when it begins to persist over time, it then can be burnout, or can even turn into what's called like chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, something like that is lasting like at least 6 months. So you would still have those same types of indicators, right? But the time is what's different. And when it comes to what you're experiencing physically, you know, tension, feeling very just lethargic, not able to really move, you know, yourself the way that you are accustomed to. And also want to take into consideration that it's not just physical sometimes. It can even impact our ability to concentrate. So you might be, you know, moving pretty freely, right? But you aren't able to sit down and hone in the way that you're accustomed to doing. So it's important for us to make that distinguishment between what's happening with us physically, emotionally, and mentally.
I'm speaking with Samantha Coleman, a professor in industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. Professor Coleman, how does this differ from something like depression or stress or anxiety? Because I think a lot of those things that you just described might be common for someone who's going through depression or anxiety, too.
I think that's an excellent question. And I would say like the key differentiator between the two, right? So burnout and like a clinical diagnosis such as depression is really about the self. And what I mean by that is when an individual becomes depressed, you know, sometimes there is a loss of self-confidence, self-hatred, sometimes even contempt, and that is directed toward the individual. Whereas when it comes to burnout, I think it tends to step outside of the self. So if I am feeling, you know, angry, if you will, or I am frustrated because I am burned out, that anger is then directed towards the organization. It isn't looked at, you know, like I am the cause, you know, of the issue, you know, per se, because we're looking at, again, the relationship between the individual and their work and feeling overworked. And so when there's that struggle like that, you tend to look outward as opposed to looking inward the same way that you would with depression.
And so we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that the World Health Organization has just changed and clarified the definition of burnout. Why is it important to draw these distinctions? How does defining this help you study this and then, I imagine, also treat burnout?
Absolutely. So for myself, I don't treat clinically. What I do, however, as an executive coach, work with a ton of leaders, and burnout is right there at the top of what they're experiencing and why they have difficulty in really leading their organizations, right? Because what they're experiencing is that inability, if you will, to navigate all of the responsibilities that they have, those of their employees, et cetera, et cetera. And so when I'm working with them, they really have that opportunity to talk about feeling guilty or of not being able to perform in the way that they would, or that they don't feel supported when they need to slow down. And so when looking at the new definition by World Health Organization, energy depletion and exhaustion, mental distance from one's job, reduced professional productivity, these are all key pieces that come up, not just with leaders and organizations, of course, but across pretty much everyone, I would say, you know, has experienced this at some point, myself included. And so what's important here is to just simply understand that we can't do it all, you know, within our workplaces, and that we really have to make that distinguishment between ourselves and our work, and to really try and alleviate those symptoms that can come into play.
Professor Coleman, do you think this is a uniquely American problem? I think it's interesting that the World Health Organization is involved with this.
Now that is a good question. I think that as human beings, right, like no matter where you are, but this can be an international, you know, concern as well. But I think it also has to do with Americans' abilities to, one, identify that, you know what, I'm burned out, you know, right now. And then am I consciously going to take the effort to engage in activities that are really going to promote my self-care? And so in doing so, again, alleviating that guilt and not feeling ashamed that you need to take a step back and reset. Whereas, you know, internationally, it might be like, you know, more opportunities to really like engage in like that meditative space, or, you know, there's deliberate.
Or have more vacation time. I was just thinking, like, just from a practical standpoint, right?
Absolutely. You know, those things, you know, are in place in, you know, other countries. But that does not mean that they don't experience the same thing. It means that there are things there, or there are interventions, if you will, put in place for when that occurs, because it would be unfair to say that, you know, it's just Americans that experience burnout. And also, too, we cannot step away from the fact that burnout is also not just something that occurs from the professional, you know, stance. It also occurs within our personal lives as well, if we don't take the opportunity to, you know, take a step back and evaluate what's happening and what is essentially taking from our energy.
And so we've been primarily talking about burnout from a work-life standpoint. And so I wanted to just end by asking you, you mentioned self-care. What other tips or ideas or advice you have for people once they've identified this, what they should do?
Absolutely. The first thing that to me is very crucial and what takes the most work is shifting your own mentality. And what I mean by that is essentially stepping away from the need to continuously prove oneself, you know, whether it's proving yourself to family members, friends, your boss, you know, the one person that you have to make happy in this world is yourself. Okay. So you really have to get into the mindset of not needing to prove yourself to other people all the time. I think another piece too is that we have to understand that no is an absolute complete sentence. Now, of course, when we are in the workspace, we have to say no in a respectful way and, of course, provide, you know, information as to why that no is legitimate. But in that, there is that concept of self-advocacy. It's necessary for us to have conversations without shame or guilt that we need some time, some space to, you know, re-energize. I think it's also important for us to be mindful of being present in the moment. And just to go a little bit further with that in terms of being present, I want to touch on work-life balance. So we continuously hear about balancing work and life. And part of where that guilt comes from, particularly when we begin to feel burnout, is that we feel imbalanced because we think that 50% should be going toward, you know, work and 50% should be going towards our professional. But in actuality, what we really want to strive for is harmony. So there is a concept called work-life harmony, and it suggests that no aspect of our life is going to get 50-50, right? On some days, work is going to get 80% and the home life is going to get 20% and vice versa. But when we are in each of those domains, we give it 100% and we're fully present there. But when we switch to the next thing, the other piece is no longer, you know, a part of what we're doing. So when we're at home, we're at home. When we're at work, we're at work. And so there's such a blurred line these days, particularly with technology coming into play, where there's difficulty in, you know, that work and leisure, you know, line. So, you know, I also suggest really taking technology breaks. It's very easy, particularly from the workspace, to, you know, jump on a LinkedIn, right? But you're still looking at stuff that's related to your work. Even with like social media, it's very important to take that time away from anything that isn't consistently feeding you, if you will.
Right. Or
lastly,
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
And then lastly, in terms of our energy management and prioritization, we really have to get in tune with what depletes us and what restores us. So if I know that, you know, engaging in, I don't know.
Social media maybe could deplete you rather than restoring you.
Correct. I am one of those people, like, going onto social media is not good for me at all, because it's a time sucker, you know, for me. And what does that do? It ends up putting me behind. And then I feel even more like, oh, now I got to get this done. Now I got to get that done. You know, it's one of those things where you really have to look at what actions am I taking that are ultimately not going to be for my best interests. So it's extremely crucial for us to prioritize, you know, throughout the day, being very strategic in really utilizing, like, you know, or understanding like where your most energy is at. So if you're a person that has top energy within the afternoon, well, then that's where you want to schedule your most brain intensive, you know, activities. Do it there. You know, everyone isn't a morning person. So you don't want to force yourself into, you know, trying to get work done in a specific space that just isn't going to, you know, work for you. And again, it's important for you to have those conversations with people, you know, whether it's your superiors, family, friends, and so on. I think the last thing that I would want to point out as well for any listeners who might be leaders within organizations, managers, is that it's going to be important to knowing that burnout is something that happens. It happens to the best of us. I personally don't know anyone that it hasn't, you know, happened to at some point in time. But there are some individuals that it happens to quite frequently. And so it's very important for leadership to assess the culture of the organization. If you begin to get feedback that your workers are feeling not just burned out, it can also come in the guise of the engagement is low, the satisfaction is low, the productivity and performance is low. So when you begin to look at those things and you ask that question of, well, why is that? Sometimes burnout is the culprit. And if this is what you come to find out, then begin to develop a strategic plan about how you are going to support, uplift, re-energize your workforce. You know, build in those flexible schedules, remote working options, and even just like on a personal level, ask me how I'm doing. You know, acknowledge the fact that it's a high stress environment. You know, sometimes it just is what it is, right? But acknowledge that, assess my feelings, and allow for me to vent. Even sometimes people just getting that off of their chest is the perfect way for them to restore, because now I feel that someone understands me, you know? And then the last thing that I want to say too, particularly for leaders, is don't heavily rely on your high performers, okay?
Because so, then you burn them out.
Absolutely. And what you want to do, look at it like this. There are multiple people that make up your workforce, tons of unique skills, talents, diverse perspectives. So don't always rely on the one person. Instead, grow yourself as a leader by coaching and developing someone else to get to the next level as well. And this is like a key way to also minimize the burnout of your high performers.
That's Professor Samantha Coleman. She teaches industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. As she's saying, she also works with lots of executives on this issue of burnout. Professor Coleman, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
coming up after the break. If you're not looking forward to the heat this weekend, maybe you want to sit in a nice air-conditioned movie theater. There's lots of new movies out this summer, some great ones that came out earlier this year. We're going to talk about that and more with AV Club's Katie Reif. And we'd love to hear what favorite movie you've seen or are looking forward to this summer. Text us at 217-394-5765. Again, that's 217-394-5765. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
You are the best kept secret in the universe.
And I found you.
Which makes me perfect for this job.
You really think a black suit is going to solve all your problems?
No, but looks damn good on you.
Forky is the most important toy to Bonnie right now. We all have to make sure nothing happens to him.
Woody, we have a situation.
I am not a toy. I was made for soup, salad, maybe chili, and then the trash.
Jason!
Where were you?
I didn't know if you were lost. Stick with me and I'll keep you safe.
Those were snippets from Booksmart, Men in Black International, Toy Story 4, and Us. Some of our favorite movies this year, along with a few of the summer flicks that are hitting theaters soon. We're already halfway through 2019, so we thought we'd look at some of the best movies from earlier this year. And what better time to do that than the first official full week of summer, especially as next week typically kicks off the blockbuster summer movie season. Katie Reif recently wrote about some of her favorite movies for the AV Club, where she's an editor. Hey, Katie, welcome back to The 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
I hope those movies got everybody in the mood for visiting theaters. We would love to hear from you listening what your picks are for the best movies of 2019, what you're looking forward to or what you've already seen. You can text us. Our number is 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Katie, so we have to start with Booksmart because that came out. Mm-hmm. Has it been about a month or two that came out?
It's been about a month now, yeah.
Okay, so it's about two high school girls who are determined to prove to their senior class that they're not just smart but fun. It's one of a couple of movies that critics liked. It didn't do all that well at the box office, but I actually really liked Booksmart. I thought it was such a fun message. What did you think of it?
I thought Booksmart was great. I think it is absolutely one of the best films of the year so far, for my taste. It's one of the best coming-of-age kind of teen comedies that I've seen in quite a long time. I always felt like in the past that, you know, I always kind of, when I was growing up, I longed to see, you know, myself as a protagonist in a teen movie, and Booksmart did that for me.
Why do you think it wasn't more popular at the box office? Do you think people aren't going to movies as much this year? Are more people streaming? What are we seeing overall?
Well, I think, yeah, I think mainly it's an issue of the field being more crowded, because you mentioned earlier that this is the traditional start of summer movie season, but summer movie season this year began at the end of April with Avengers Endgame.
Right.
So it used to be that blockbuster films came out in the summertime and smaller indie films would, kind of hold back on releasing during that time because the box office is going to be dominated by these big, they call them tentpole movies, or if you want to get really like in the Hollywood weeds, four quadrant movies, just huge, big blockbusters. They're releasing them all year round now. And I think Booksmart kind of had the misfortune of falling in the shadow of Avengers Endgame and also Game of the last season of Game of Thrones were taking up a lot of the kind of pop culture oxygen at that time.
When you say that kind of those big franchises, we have not just Toy Story coming out, but Men in Black International too, right? So I wonder, we actually have a little clip if we can hear a little bit about the plot before we get to Men in Black, because it's kind of a classic franchise. Here's a clip from the Men in Black International.
We are a rumor, recognizable only as deja vu and dismissed just as quickly. We are the best kept secret in the universe.
I know.
I want in. You erased my parents' memories, but you didn't get mine. It took me 20 years to find you. How many people can say that? I found you, which makes me perfect for this job.
All right, that's from Men in Black. So, Katie, how is this new interpretation? Does this do the franchise justice?
I was not a huge fan of Men in Black International, which is disappointing because I was really looking forward to Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth being on screen together. And you know what? I will say that they have really great chemistry. They remind me of like siblings. They kind of like playfully tease each other. Like
they were pretty fun in Thor, right? Because they were together in Thor, right?
Absolutely, right. And it's and if you liked their kind of vibe, I guess.
Yeah, they have a good kind of shit going.
Yeah, it's very similar in Men in Black, which I imagine is kind of how they relate to each other in real life because it translated so well to another film. And also, Kumail Nanjiani has a small part in Men in Black International. He plays an alien who has kind of a funny name. It's Pawnee because he was the pawn on a chess, like an alien chessboard. It's a little silly, but he does a really good job. It's kind of like a silly stock, one-dimensional character, but he gets some really good laughs out of it. So I would. If you like those actors, what I've been telling people is that Men in Black is going to be a really great Saturday HBO movie in about a year.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Okay. So what about Toy Story? Because that's another movie franchise that is beloved. It's been about almost 25 years. I mean, first of all, you do need to see the other. Do you feel like you need to see the other ones to enjoy this one?
Well, let's say, like, if you had, like, a real young kid or something like that and you wanted to take them, first of all, these movies are sad, just FYI. And secondly, no, you could follow the plot without seeing the other movies, but if you wanted to get the full emotional impact of the characters and kind of their evolution and their journey and that sort of thing, then I would recommend seeing the other Toy Stories beforehand.
So those are the blockbusters. Those are things that maybe people are looking forward to. I wonder about when we think about movies that have been so far, what you think are the best movies of this year. I wanted to ask you about Us. We played a little clip from that in the beginning. This is Jordan Peele's sophomore feature. And it's hard to follow something like Get Out, Katie, right? Because I thought Get Out was so good and so well done. And I, you know, I don't like scary movies, which is why I haven't seen Us yet. It took me a really long time to see Get Out, and then I loved it. But
yeah.
Would you say that, I mean, how would you describe Us in terms of the scary movie genre? Is it more kind of Hitchcock suspense? Is it more, where would it go?
Oh, gosh. Well, Us is a movie that, I mean, it is definitely a horror movie as opposed to a thriller. And how I would define the difference is there's a podcast, if someone is interested in digging into this deeper, it's called Unspooled with Amy Nicholson and Paul Scheer. Went to a live taping and they had a long discussion about what defines horror versus thriller. But for me, it's like you have a gut feeling of dread or fear, and a thriller is more like exciting. But this is definitely horror in that it's got a lot of kind of like really symbolic imagery that kind of, it's a little more all over the place than Get Out. It's a little more obscure. Like, Get Out is a very complete statement. You know,
it's pretty tight. It's a very clear narrative that's happening in Get Out.
Yes. And Us is a little more, you know, takes a few more side tracks and has a few more kind of the word I want to use is opaque, as in it's kind of, you have to kind of give it some thought to try to figure out what you think Jordan Peele is trying to say in Us, as opposed to Get Out, where, you know, it's a very like clear thought. But it's still a very, it's a very interesting movie, and Lupita Nyong'o just knocks it out of the park. She does so well. I'm always advocating for horror actresses to get Academy Award nominations, and I really hope Lupita Nyong'o gets one for Us, because her work in the movie is so incredible.
And so I was actually listening this weekend to Lupita Nyong'o was on the Bad Brown Aunties podcast, and I wanted to play a little bit because it was really fascinating to hear about how Jordan Peele had her prepare for this role.
Jordan Peele, he really pays homage to the canon of horror film. So I wanted to know what influences he was working from. So he gave me a list of 10 films to watch.
Do you want to share any of that list of 10?
Yeah, sure. There was Dead Again, Let the Right One In, A Tale of Two Sisters. That one is terrifying. The Birds, Hitchcock. Signs, Martyrs, The Babadook, Annihilation.
Did you watch most of these by yourself?
No, I didn't watch a single one by myself.
That's Lupita Nyong'o on the Bad Brown Aunties podcast talking about preparing for the movie Us. Katie, I wonder if you've seen
That's
any of the movies she mentioned.
Movies.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's a pretty intense list of movies. Some of those are pretty terrifying on that list. Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Do you see that reflected in the movie as well then? All of these super intense horror movies that Jordan Peele was influenced by?
Yeah, there is some elements in there of part of it is a what you call a home invasion movie, where Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke and their kids, they're at their vacation house, and then a family that looks exactly like them breaks into the house and kind of holds them hostage. And there, and on that list, there are a few kind of intense home invasion movies, because it's a very terrifying trope. You know, I think a lot of people, even if you don't believe in vampires or something like that, then you would be frightened by the idea of someone breaking into your house.
Okay, yeah, I'm definitely not going to see this movie. So can I ask you about when we're thinking about all of these things, we mentioned this, Us is clearly a really original film, but a lot of the things we've talked about are either remakes or I'm thinking about Godzilla or Aladdin, Lion King. How many, I wonder how much movies, I feel like we go through cycles where there's just tons of remakes that kind of happen.
Absolutely. And it is cyclical. Like, for example, if you think about in the mid-90s, you had a Flintstones movie and the Brady Bunch movie and a bunch of older 70s, Beverly Hillbillies movie, a bunch of 70s and 60s TV shows were turned into movies in the 90s. And then in the 2000s, you had the Red Dawn remake, for example, like classic 80s movies getting remade. And now we're in the point in the cycle where classic 90s movies are getting remade. And I personally, there's been a bit of a dip. A lot of the big, you know, remakes and sequels you're talking about are have underperformed so far. I personally think Lion King is going to be very big simply because of the cast that's in it. I mean, Beyonce's in it, so there's definitely a large built-in audience there. But I think people, what happens is that studios, you know, think, oh, well, it's familiar, so people want to see something familiar. And they do for a while, but then they kind of get tired of it. And so studios are forced to look for something new. And then they make sequels to that. And then, you know, the cycle continues.
Well, so when we think about, Katie, we started this conversation by talking about how the traditional summer blockbuster movie season is kind of gone, especially this year as we think about streaming. And I don't want to leave that out. And I just wanted to ask you, I think all the half of the producers, I would say at least, and myself would say Always Be My Maybe is one of our favorite films of the year.
Yes.
And actually,
yes.
I did see it was playing in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, also in movie theaters, but it's available on Netflix. What great movies are we that are being released just on streaming are you most interested in so far this year?
Well, the big one that I would recommend just hit Netflix yesterday, and that is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature last year. That just hit Netflix yesterday, and I would highly recommend that film. Even if you're not really into superhero films, it's got a lot of really great, innovative animation in it that you can appreciate it.
It really is so unusual. And what about original Netflix releases, things that are just being released to Netflix or another streaming service?
Let's see. In terms of movies?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, honestly, Always Be My Maybe. And if you catch up with Netflix's rom-coms are really popular right now for good reason, I think. Catch up with last year's All the Boys That I Loved Before, if you haven't caught up with that one.
Right, because there's going to be really a sequel stuff. Soon, too, right?
Yes, there is.
As all of the teenagers in my life have informed me, there is...
But you know what? I mean, normally I don't even really see rom-coms in the theater, but I'm really charmed by all of Netflix.
They are very charming. They're very charming, yeah. And they're fun. Normally, also, they're nice, like, families. Everybody can watch, all ages can normally watch those together.
Yeah, they don't usually go R-rated with those. Right.
All right. Well, Katie, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your favorite movies and what you're looking forward to. Katie Reif is a news editor with the AV Club. We'll tweet out her stories as well. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me back on, and a happy summer.
Thank you. That does it for us this week. We hope you enjoy your weekend. You can always find more information about us at 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.